We can move to item number 11. Elk general and special permit seasons. This is a rural briefing and public hearing for 2012-2014 time period. Dr. Nelson.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Nelson. I'm the Deer and Elk Section Manager for Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm going to brief you on our proposals for the three-year package for elk general seasons and elk special permits. To begin with, as you probably saw in your packet, the number one public comment that we received on our hunting seasons this go-around for elk was the timing of the early archery elk season. Currently, the early archery begins the Tuesday after Labor Day and is running 13 days, closing on a Sunday. The concerns expressed included the timing of the elk breeding season, the contentious nature of trying to hunt in warm weather, just the conditions, but also trying to maintain meat once the animal's been harvested, also the fire danger, folks being restricted to places they can and cannot go because there's enough fire danger that certain parts of the outdoors are locked out because of fire danger, and then of course not enough days, not enough length in the season as a whole. To sort of get back to some of the history on this and the last three-year package on how we landed where we're at currently on the early archery elk season. Before the last three-year package, early archery elk was running September 8 to September 21. We made the change, or we proposed the change, the commission adopted the change to the early archery season in the last three-year package, and that was motivated by a disproportionate number of larger bulls being harvested during the early archery elk season. Comparing the number of participants to the proportion of animals being harvested, especially in the larger branch antler bulls. The current archery season, as it stands now, also allows room for the new categories that we have, especially the quality modern firearm special permits that are sort of wedged in between the early archery elk and the beginning of early muzzleloader deer season opening. And by doing it that way, we managed to have an early archery season, a quality modern firearm special permit season in a lot of locations, and then opening muzzleloader deer season on the last Saturday of September without having any overlaps between any of those weapon types. So the calendar is jam-packed as it sits right now. And currently, although we understand the input from the archers on early elk season, we don't have a recommendation to change early archery elk general season at this time. Okay, using the status table again in terms of status of elk populations and how that might equate to any hunting season changes that we might be proposing to you all. For the Mount St. Helens herd, you've heard us talk about the Mount St. Helens herd a number of times. We believe that population is still above objective. We've been providing some pretty aggressive hunting opportunities for both bulls and antlerless in the 15 or so game management units that make up the Mount St. Helens elk herd. We are recommending status quo for the antlerless opportunity to continue that pressure. We are recommending some reduction in the bull permits, reduced back to the 2010 levels, not because we think we're over-harvesting bulls, but because we're getting an awful lot of feedback from the public on crowding. Especially in places like the Margaret and the Tootle. Those are the two primary special permit units on the west side. Most of the western game management units are general season units with a 3-point minimum season structure. So when I say proposing reductions, that's specific to those special permit areas, Margaret Tootle. I would also mention for the Mount St. Helens herd and also Clockham, Blue Mountains, and Nooksack, this sort of harkens back to the comment that Director Anderson made a little while ago when he was explaining floor changes. Those four herds we fly every year, but there are flights that take place in March, and so we're conducting our meeting today, but the flights to confirm what we're proposing to do for hunting seasons will be happening in the next 2 to 3 weeks on Mount St. Helens, on Clockham, Blue Mountains, and also Nooksack. And so there's still some work there that happens every year. It's scheduled as best times for us to be flying animals, flying surveys for elk in those herds. And so not likely to happen, but there's always that possibility that we would come back to you at the April meeting in light of something that we saw in those flights that might suggest a change, but not likely to happen, but there's always that possibility.
Pardon us. Commissioner Duvia.
thanks, Madam Chair. Jerry, could you give me a comment on the Clockham one? We discussed it at the Wildlife Committee last night, but I'd be interested in your thoughts. We have a unacceptable bull-cow ratio problem there and have had for years. And the strategy to increase bull permits, increase antlers permits, what's your thinking on how that's going to solve the extreme low bull-cow ratio?
I'll touch on that in a couple of slides down the road.
Okay, fine.
We'll get to that in a second. Moving on down through the table, the Yakima herd, same strategy here as you saw in some of the deer tables. When we're able to fly these herds and get reasonable either population estimates or estimates of composition, we'll be able to provide you some measure of whether those herds are at the objective we've set in the elk management plans. For those herds where we don't have good survey systems currently in place, again, we're relying mostly on harvest data to inform our decisions in terms of consistency in harvest across years. So for the Yakima herd, we do fly that herd pretty extensively every year at the same time that we're flying the elk that do not routinely use the feed sites, and we have some segment of the population that does both. Some use the feed sites, others winter on relatively natural winter range. We try to conduct that activity all at the same time, and so we have aerial surveys that we conduct for the segment of the herd that's off the feed sites at the same time we're doing a full head count on the feedlots. Those numbers are looking pretty good. The herd is at objective, but we feel comfortably increase both the branch antler bull permits and the antlerless permits and maintain that herd at objective. For the Clockham herd, as I said, those flights are yet to come, but we are going to be proposing a slight increase in bull permits and a slight increase in some antlerless hunting opportunity. For the Blue Mountains, again, slight increase, but increases in the bull special permit harvest targets that we're looking at there. That's another herd that flights are soon and pending, will happen this month. For the elk on the Olympic Peninsula, and we had a little bit of a discussion about this earlier today, these are the elk that are not living within the boundaries of the Olympic National Park, but all around the outlying areas. We get that information from the National Park, but it doesn't necessarily play into what we're talking about here. We're on a multi-year effort that's a collaborative effort with several of the tribes that work on the peninsula to get a total estimate for elk on the Olympic Peninsula. This is something that we do every 7 to 10 years. We try to update our elk management plan for the Olympics when we do that. It's not ideal. Ideally, you'd be conducting a population estimate all in 1 year, but it's such an extensive area and it's such an expensive effort. Requires having radio collared animals on the ground, as well as doing a number of flights throughout. So we bite off chunks every year and try to get it done in the course of a few years, and it's a fairly extensive partnership with both us and the a number of the tribes on the peninsula that are interested in elk management. For the Willapa Hills herd, we really do have to rely on harvest data for the Willapa Hills. We're hoping that a lot of the lessons that we learned coming out of the Mount St. Helens research will get us to a practical but effective population estimation technique to be applied in Willapa Hills. And so until we get to that point, right now we're relying on harvest data and recommending status quo for that herd as well. For the Nooksack, even though the total population is below objective, we have managed to reach and have maintained a level that we've spelled out in the elk management plan that allows us to do some limited special permit bull hunting. And so we're actually expecting to raise those special permit levels in the Nooksack for bulls again slightly, but that's pending flights that'll be happening in the next couple of weeks. So you'll see something from us on that at the April meeting, hopefully a slight increase on those bull permits. For the Selkirk, really relying on harvest data there as well. The big change that we'll talk about in a few slides is shifting from an any elk opportunity in a number of the GMUs in Northeast to an any bull opportunity, with the intent to promote growth in that elk population per the Selkirk Elk Herd Management Plan. North Rainier and South Rainier, we rely on harvest data for both of those as well, and recommending status quo for those as well. Now, a lot of interest in Clackam elk, and so we'll talk a little bit about Clackam elk. We did have Scott McCorkadale and Will Moore come in and give you a nice presentation last month about all the details of, or a lot of the details of Clackam elk herd and elk management, and also some of the inroads we're making on developing some road management models that we can use to inform management decisions on trying to affect road closures that might benefit elk and elk management. This is just a time series of population estimates from about 2000 to 2011. For those of you of the more analytical bent, this represents the red line, the point estimates for that herd, and then the blue dotted lines represents the upper and lower confidence intervals. Now, a lot of you would look at this slide and potentially cringe a little bit at the early years gaps in those confidence intervals and marvel at just how wide they are, just about big enough to drive a truck through. But as the years progress, they really sort of tighten up and operate the way you'd hope a population estimate would work. But then in the most recent years, you see them get so tight that you start to get a little skeptical and worried that something might not be working properly. So we can explain that. The primary thing that's happening here is that the population estimation technique that we're using here is a model, that, a sightability model that was developed by the folks in Idaho back in the 80s. And so the idea here is that you divide your landscape up into sampling survey units. You stratify those sampling survey units by some measure of density. Typically, that's something like high, medium, or low. And then the protocol suggests, urges, insists that you fly all of the high density units somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 80% of the medium density units and 20 to 30% of the low density units. And so those units that you don't fly are part of the thing that's adding into the model the variability in the model, and that variability is what's contributing to the precision of these estimates. Okay, so in the early years, in that neighborhood of 1999, 2000, 2001, staff were just sort of getting their arms around using this technique, and they weren't flying all of the units that they should have been flying. And so that was contributing to an awful lot of variability and making those confidence intervals awfully wide. And there was also some issues with stratification. So, you know, if we're stratifying something as a medium or a low and it's something else, that could be contributing to the variability as well. As time goes by, we get a little bit better handle on using this technique and flying all or at least the proportions of the strata that we should be flying. But then in the late 2000s, if you look at kind of progressing on from 2007 to 2011, that's where we've gotten to the point where we're literally flying every single sampling unit. And so because you're flying every single sampling unit, this is, we're surveying all of the known winter range for this herd that we know about. And so we're no longer leaving any of the sampling units out. And if you're not leaving any of the sampling units out, that variability isn't contributing into the model. And so even though it looks like these confidence intervals are incredibly tight, you have to keep that in mind because it's a little bit of a flaw in the model rather than we're just doing a perfect bang-up job.
Commissioner Jennings.
Sorry, my biostatistics background, it makes me want to jump in a little bit here because what you're saying sort of makes sense, but it also sort of implies that when you're doing the sampling, you have 100% confidence that you're sampling each individual within those individual strata?
No, so I didn't cover that part.
Okay.
But that also contributes to the variability and also contributes to the precision of the estimates. And so the sightability part of these sightability bias models, some of the inputs into the model are the things that would make groups more or less visible. And so a very large group that's in wide open space without any timber is going to be highly visible. Small groups of 10 to 20 with forest that's inhibiting your visibility, 20, 30, 40, 50% forest cover, something like that, is going to make them less visible. And so the model will add in, based on those sighting probabilities, will add in missed animals. And so that's part of the functioning of the model, too. The other trick with this is if you have a sampling unit and you only fly one low strata in that sampling mix, that's not going to contribute any variability either because you've only flown one, and so there's no measure of detectability, sort of a thing. I know I'm not making that very clear, but the things that contribute to the model in terms of the visibility bias that you're asking about would be things like forest cover, is there snow cover on the ground, how big are the groups, standing, moving, bedded down, all of those things used in model development were determined to be parameters that we're going to use these parameters to make the model function in terms of detectability. I can get you some information if you'd like a better explanation.
Those are just awfully tight for wildlife population estimates, and I think you told us earlier, if I remember correctly, that you might be using a camera to help do the counts later.
Yes, we are, and that's another piece of this misleading look of precision as well, is that in about 2007, I believe it was, on these really large groups of 200-300 animals, they started using photographs to double check their counts, and learned that they were probably underestimating some. And so now you're talking about a very wide open landscape that doesn't have a lot of visibility interference, and you've added in this new component of photography to help you refine your counts even more. And so that's functioning here as well. But even in these later years, where it looks like there really isn't any spread at all, it's sort of the scale of the graph, the model is still adding in a few missed animals.
It sort of feels like I've pulled us off on a tangent. It is late. I don't want to get the other commissioners too annoyed with me. So
I don't mind. Okay. So anyway, circling back to Clockamouc. Clockamouc is important. So to sort of unclutter the graph and get away from the confidence intervals for a second, here are just the point estimates over that same time period, but also the population objectives that we've spelled out in the elk management plan for the Clockam herd. And so the two green lines represent the upper and the lower bounds or fences for what we've determined to be the population objective for the Clockam elk herd management plan. And so if we're hitting somewhere within those two green lines, or potentially if your CIs are hitting within those, we feel like we're in pretty good shape. And so up and through the last 3 years, 09, 2010, 2011, we're at that upper level or maybe even a little above. And we anticipate our flights this year are going to suggest that continuing trend. And so coming back to Commissioner Duvia's question, that's one of the things that's informing our decision to, can we increase bull permits a little bit and provide a little bit of opportunity? Can we increase some permits and some archery general season for antlerless and provide a little bit of opportunity at this snapshot? Population is at or above objective. Where we're really, as you pointed out, struggling is more the number of bulls in the population. Now, those last two slides and this slide are slides that you saw when Scott and Will gave you the presentation last month. This is another one that I just wanted to hit on a little bit, and this comes back to, well, what are we doing about the lack of number of bulls in the Clockam elk population? So this graph shows us the general season bull harvest for the Clockam since 1987. In those early years, it was an any bull season structure. You'll notice in 94, that's when we first went to the spike-only season structure, where the general season opportunity was one by one or one by two bulls, and the branch antler bulls were only by special permit. And then in 2009, we shifted to this true spike-only, where to be a legal bull in the general season, you had to be a one-by-one bull and nothing more. The shading just reminds you that you saw last month that these harvest data were collected in a couple of different ways over the course of time. And so up through about 2000, we were using a three-wave mailer to get at our harvest data. In 2001, we started the mandatory reporting system, and so that's that's what the current information is. So I'll just get that out of the way for the moment, and you can see the whole graph. And so what you really see here is from for a long time, we're in a general season sense spike only. We're bouncing around a 300 or so general season bull harvest, 300 to some years up into the 400s. The last 2 years, the 2009 and the 2010, when we've implemented the true spike season, you see that, and these are mostly in the recent years. These are going to be yearling bulls because that's really only that's what's legal in the general season. And we're not looking at special permit season here. So you see that harvest dropping down in 2009 and 2010. That's what we wanted to see. That's what we were hoping for. We applied an additional antler restriction to try to get some more yearling bull survival, and we're seeing a little bit of that happening. This is sort of the take-home message to that that whole story. And this is the information that was also provided to you last month, and this is the percentage of yearling bulls that we're harvesting in this general season. And so you see for a long time, the Clockham herd averaging about 82% of the yearling bulls being harvested. And in comparison, for the Yakima herd, same season structure, but we're only harvesting about 70% of the yearling bulls, and that's functioning pretty nicely for us. For the Blue Mountains, even lower than that, and that's functioning pretty nicely for us. And so, true spike, we've only got 2 years. The 2011 data, we're working on that now, and so hopefully by April I'll be able to show you yet another year on this graph. That's our first best attempt at trying to do something about the better bull survival.
Commissioner Duvia has a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks, Jerry. I guess I'm just really concerned about this particular herd. We have gone from 8,000 to 10,000 hunters participating in this thing down to 4,000. We've gone down from 400 bulls harvested down to 150. We've been on a spike, I guess, policy to try to enhance bull population for 15 or more years, and we're at an all-time low. I think we're down 2 to 5 postseason bull-to-cow ratio. I'm just nervous that, and we just got the overall population back to where it should be. Unfortunately, it's mostly cows. So I just don't know if we have all the right plan in place. I mean, we've been beating this spike only policy to death. It doesn't seem like it's maybe not the exact tool that fits this herd. But we're at a point where we need, I think, to assess that whole concept and what all the things. There must be another part of this package we're missing. And that we talked about road closures, and I'm not sure what the fix is, but I don't know how many more years I would go without results. It just makes me real nervous. I hope that we put our heads together to see, make sure we don't have too many more years. There won't be any hunting up there. So we need to, I think, really apply ourselves and try to come up with the package. And I'm still confused whether or not taking more cows out and taking more bulls out is going to really help us next year. Maybe we need to totally shut down the bull harvest. Maybe we need to do something drastic. I think most hunters are enthusiastic about recovery and getting this thing back to normal, because right now it's mostly an act of frustration for most of the people that go up there. So anyway, I'd like to just express my concerns, and I'd really like us to really think if there's any other tools we need to do between now and our next meeting to see if we can add or finesse or enhance our plan to get this thing turned around.
Commissioner Schmitten.
Thank you, Chairman. You know, for the most part, today has been my day to listen and learn. But this clock and milk issue is in my backyard. It's come up a couple times today, and and I'd like to share my thoughts. No doubt about it, we have reached the herd objective after some 15, 20 years of trying to get here, barely. But in my view, the clock and milk herd continues to struggle. We know the issues. We know the problems. We just heard from Commissioner Duvier. It's a low bull-to-cow ratio. It's an unknown level of tribal harvest. It's a true spike requirement that has really not produced the increases or results that we'd hoped for bull-to-cow ratio. And we need a road management plan, meaning we need road closures. And there was a new one we just heard this morning that I thought was interesting and raised some new concerns. And we heard about numerous 4x4s that have been chained up and operated by people seeking sheds. And they're doing this by running the herds to try to get them to cast their sheds. Now, that is sheer harassment in my view. You're running cows that are impregnated in large herds. And it just interesting because I remembered last night reading the delegation of authority to the director under page 5, section H, which is real and personal property. And the last sentence says the director may grant permits to individuals for the collection from the department lands of naturally shed antlers of deer, elk, or moose. So perhaps we have a tool to sign and close those areas for collection of sheds during certain times unless they're authorized specifically by the director. That's one point. But the bigger point, this is all part of trying to seek a quality hunt after two decades, and I think it's tied directly to road closures. We're not going to get there until we're successful in slowing down the access, bringing about a more quality hunt, taking people off of road hunting and putting them out in the field and truly enjoying the sport. So my thoughts have been building up and listening to this, and I wanted to share them.
Commissioner Perry, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I would agree with what both other commissioners have outlined here. I had the same thoughts. There was one other point that I did want to bring up on this. On the essentially the south side of the Clallam, they've instituted a winter closure for motorized vehicles, and it's a type of an area where it's pretty far to walk or bike or anything like that, so it's pretty much of a closure. And it sounds like from what I've a couple of meetings I've been to, the department has presented information that it's to some degree working, that the elk are wintering elk are using that those areas, and they're pretty much free from harassment. And, is it possible to establish something like that on the north end of the Clallam, where there's a lot of damage, kill, and so forth? Again, I'm worried about the bull population too. If you look in the big game assessment document that that we recently got, and do the calculation, there's less than way less than one mature bull per 100 cows in the Clallam. There's apparently a lot of yearlings and so forth, and it's obviously the cows are getting bred because the population seems to be going up according to your data. But it seems to me like there needs to be more adult bulls. But I just wondered if any kind of a winter closure like that that would maybe mitigate this this antler hunting that Commissioner mentioned and so forth, would that be possible?
You're getting a little out of my division and into the lands division, but I believe so, and I think any of those types of protections would definitely provide some benefit. We're seeing that in a lot of other states, lands that the state wildlife agencies manage and control. If they're functioning as winter range for deer or elk or sometimes even moose, some western states have gotten fairly restrictive on that kind of stuff. The balance, I believe, is the other recreation aspects of public land. So yes, I wouldn't disagree with anything you've said.
I guess I asked that a little bit wrong. I really, what I wanted to ask you, do you think that would help
the
situation that we're talking about here
in terms of
elk, and particularly this most recent thing about the shed hunting and actually baiting to recover sheds and that sort of thing? It didn't seem to me like that should be a proper thing, but I've heard of it.
I agree. I think it would be helpful, and I think it would have a benefit, and I don't think anybody here would suggest that we want to stop shed hunting, but if we could just delay it to a time period when it wasn't having as much of a negative impact on elk when they're on pretty limited resources, end of the winter, as you said, you know, carrying calves, that sort of stuff, yeah, that would definitely help.
Thank you.
Commissioner Jennings?
I'll be brief, and this is a tangent, so is this part of the conversation relative to your focus, and that is your comment about I don't think anybody's opposed to shed hunting, and I'll push back a little bit.
Okay.
Calcium is a pretty hard element to find for wildlife, and when you look at the sheds, you see that they're often gnawed on by a variety of species, mice, other places, turtles, when I was back in Georgia. And so removing those in a very widespread way is actually taking nutrients away from the land. So from where I sit, it's not a given that we let all sheds be harvested. It's we figure out where that balance is between long-term ecosystem health and the desire for people to have the sheds for whatever reasons they want to. So I just want to put that on the record that to me it's not a yes, go get them. It's a what are the wildlife and ecosystem considerations before we make that decision on wildlife lands.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you do. Director Anderson.
You're, I'm trying to read your mind. We've had some extensive work and analysis done on road closures in this area. We gave a presentation to the commission here in, I believe, February on this matter. And it's a multifaceted issue. We've looked at road closures as a means to try to keep elk on their winter range and keep them off of ag land. We've used road closures to reduce disturbance of herds, and yet we also know that the road closures that we have currently in place have been very controversial for us. Not to say that everyone is opposed to them, not in the least. We've had a lot of people that recognize the value and benefit from road closures from a number of different perspectives. But I think what I am growing increasingly concerned about is the behavior of people on these public lands that are in large part intended to support healthy wildlife populations. And there may well be a need for us to get our hands around and have tighter control on the number of individuals out doing this type of activity, maybe through some sort of a permit process, as Commissioner Schmitten sort of suggested, to ensure that we know how many people are out there and that we control it to the extent that it would result in the benefit of the wildlife, and in this case, the Clackam elk herd. So we've got some more work to do. We've done quite a little bit, as was demonstrated in February. We're taking this conversation and this issue very seriously, and you can be assured that we'll be talking more about it internally and then coming back to the commission with some additional follow-up from February.
Great. Terrific. Thank you. Okay.
So moving into the specifics that I've sort of hit upon already, and I always like talking about increased opportunity, although I think there's a more than fair debate here to be had whether we should be allowing increased opportunity here. Slight increase proposed for some Clockham special permits for bulls, and also some proposed antlerless opportunity in the Clockham herd, both in general season archery and some special permits. An increase in Blue Mountains special permits for bulls, as mentioned before. Overall bull numbers and overall elk numbers in the Blue Mountains are looking good per the elk management plan, and we think we've got some room to increase opportunity there. Definitely have some substantial increases in special permits for some of the Yakima game management units for branch antler bulls. We also have some increased proposed increased opportunity for antlerless elk in the Yakima units as well. We want to we like having that population at objective or even at its upper objectives, but we want to keep it there. We don't want it to get too large. And then, as I mentioned before, the potential for some additional bull permits for the Nooksack herd, and those will be hinging on some aerial surveys that we'll be conducting here in the next couple of weeks. Also on the Selkirk elk herd specifically, we're recommending changing GMUs 101, 105, 108, 121, and 121 and GMU 204 from an any elk hunting season structure to an any bull season structure. Ultimately, down the road, we have a couple of hunts proposed for antlerless special permits in these units, ultimately, we would control antlerless opportunity through special permits, allow the general season through any bull, and the intention here is to promote additional growth in that elk population and in the long term create more elk hunting opportunity in those units. And this is something that we've spelled out in the Selkirk elk herd management plan. And then on the elk side of things, the one floor amendment that I have for you is on this agenda item on page 38. I think some of you have been briefed on this already, but I'm not sure all of you have. But one of the things that the department is negotiating is trying to get some access to the Arid Lands Ecology Reserve, the Hanford site, to have an elk hunt. It's something that we've been trying to effect for a long time. The entities involved in the negotiations include us, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Yakima Nation, and to much lesser extent, the Department of Energy. We think we're getting close to a resolution here. There is an elk hunting plan developed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for Arid Lands Ecology Reserve. And so if that continues to move forward, we're hoping to have some limited special permit antlerless hunting on Hanford. The way we propose to accommodate that this first year would be to do that through the Master Hunter antlerless on-demand type permits. And so we're proposing increasing the Region 3 20 permits to 75 permits. These are permits that can be used anywhere in Region 3 as the need arises. And so the intention here would be to at least for the first season, use these permits to try to accommodate that hunt and then figure out a more developed process in the years to come. And so we're proposing increasing that level. So that's a floor amendment, page 38, changing those 20 permits to 75. HC. HC is our designation for on-demand permits. So you don't go hunting until the department has a need, and we give the hunters a call. And if there are any other additional questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Commissioner Perry.
Thank you. I wanted to just ask a couple of questions on the Selkirk elk herd and your proposals for hunting that. I wondered if, first of all, if that takes into consideration what wolves might be taking. And second, is there any indication that wolves are having an impact on elk in that area? We've talked earlier about significant wolf activity in the area where the elk would occur, I think, in that area.
Right, and we don't know what the impact is up to this point. I know our folks that are doing the wolf work are monitoring some kills, but I don't think they're able to get information on every single kill. They're obviously killing and eating elk. Don't know what that level of impact is, but more importantly, difficult to predict as those wolf populations increase and get more widespread and more established what that's going to look like in the future. Certainly going from an any elk to an any bull season would reduce the mortality for the reproductive age female segment of the population, at least from the hunting standpoint. How much of that would be accommodated by other sources of mortality, in this case predation? Don't know the answer to that, can't predict that yet. It really depends on is it a totally additive type of system, or is it compensatory, or typically it's some mixture of the two. And so our best foot forward would be to try to develop some better monitoring population estimation, or at least population indices for elk up in the Northeast, and monitor those elk more intensively as wolves continue to expand. We don't have, other than harvest data, a lot of good information on Selkirk elk right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Jerry, I've had several hunters directly contact me, and I have read at least one article about, I'm not sure exactly the location, but I assume it's in the Nooksack or the Willapa herd, that they have a significant wolf disease or hoof disease?
That's more in Region 5 than any place else. It's a hoof rot condition. It's becoming more and more widespread and more problematic, spreading throughout Region 5 and seeing some in other places. It's a condition that historically we would see an observation here or an observation there, but what we're seeing now isn't anything like that. It's a good deal greater and a good deal more widespread. Our initial looks into this, we had our veterinarian, Dr. Mansfield, go out and collect some elk and take samples of those animals. She brought along a pathologist from Washington State University, and so they were able to take all those samples back to the lab at Pullman and do a fairly extensive analysis of those. Unfortunately, we really didn't come away with a cause, a smoking gun, and more importantly, a solution. As it turns out, we're being told that there could be upwards of 40 different things that causes this kind of hoof rot. Some bacterial, some viral, some nutritional deficiencies, all sorts of, you name it. What we're seeing in the individual animals is a fair amount of disproportionate growth in the keratin, the hooves. The toe-like structures are getting longer and misshapen. We're also getting a lot of broken skin, sores, bleeding, limping. It's pretty gruesome stuff. What we've asked Dr. Mansfield to do, and we're going to help her as much as we can on this, is we're going to convene a meeting this early summer or midsummer, try to bring in some additional experts from outside, from potentially out of state, wherever we can find them, and try to bring folks in and tell them what we're seeing and what we've learned so far, and see if they can give us some help and some guidance on what we can look for next and what we can look into in terms of pathological investigations. I'm told that probably the preeminent expert on this topic is actually in Australia, so I don't think we'll be flying anybody in from Australia, but I'm thinking, you know, in this day of technology, you know, why not use Skype to bring that person in and have them be part of that meeting and part of that workshop. And so I wish I could paint a better picture. We're still looking for answers, and we certainly don't have any solutions, but it really is becoming a big, big problem. We're getting reports constantly and in a lot of different places and extensive impacts to groups of animals, of groups of elk.
Okay, very good. Then that completes your presentation?
Yes, ma'am.
Very good. Do we have anyone? We do have public testimony. Okay. Thank you all for being patient. First of all, I'd like to call up Don Lovell and Mike Britton. Okay, Mr. Lovell.
Yes. In looking at Table 9 and Table 13 in your Selkirk plan, if you look at the numbers here, and both these tables prove that your elk herd is growing. So the question is, we got a growing elk herd, but yet we want to make it grow more. We don't have any problems as far as rancher complaints yet. So the question, when we went to the meeting, was asked why, and we were told there at that particular time it was because of some sportsmen's group wanted more elk. Today, we're hearing maybe it's because they're wanting more elk because of the wolf. So if it's because we're trying to have more elk for when the wolf becomes a problem, that makes more sense, other than it won't do any good. If it's just because a few people seem to think we need to have more elk, we're getting more elk every year. It's proven fact if you just look at the figures here. They're killing more elk every year. It's taking less man days to do it. Even in the units where we have permits only, 2001 you killed 4 elk, 2010 you killed 25. So it's obviously there's more elk out there because there are more elk to be taken. So I don't understand why we're going to go to a bulls only unless we're trying to have more elk when we have a problem. And I'll tell you again, it isn't going to do any good. I read that 300-page report 2 years ago on wolves, and I walked away with only one conclusion, and that is, if you've got wolves, you're not going to have elk. Because when you have 80% failure rate in reproduction and only 20% hitting the ground, and the wolves and the bears, the cats are going to eat those 20%, you're going to end up just like your neighbor is. You got a plummeting elk herd, and there's nothing going to stop it as long as you have too many predators. And as far as what's going to happen, I asked 2 years ago if we had a man on the ground in Idaho to see what was going to happen. I got told no. Game Department, do we have a man in Idaho yet on the ground to see what they've done? and actually went over there and looked, or are we just reading paper? Or has anybody actually went over there and looked? I've been over there. I hunted over there. The scary is nobody wants to cross a line over here to go look. Well, your answers are across the border. They're not in a piece of paper. They're sitting right over there. They got up 15 years of this, and nobody wants to go find out what their problems are and their cures are. I hate to tell you, they're telling you you're killing 250 wolves a year in Idaho. People, take a look at the wolf population. Look at how many breeding pair you got. Look at their success ratio, and look at how many wolves are raising to maturity in December. Folks, they've had 1,200 wolves for 10 years. They're not killing 250 wolves a year over there. They're killing 800 to 1,000 wolves a year over there, and they're losing the battle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Would Rick Harwood come forward, please? Mr. Britton, you can go ahead.
My name is Mike Britton. I've been a master hunter for a long time, and I appreciate all the efforts you guys are putting in. I've been in a commission like yourself, and I know exactly what it's all about. The first thing I want to mention is we pay for some exceptional biologists like Kevin Robinette and some of the crews over in the, on the east side of the state there, and we appreciate the biology of taking care of the animals and the hunters. They don't get to work directly with the landowner relationships, and the master hunters get to do that. The individual hunters are the ones that get to work on those landowner relationships. If we're going to make political decisions, things that decide the seasons, how they're going to be modified, disregarding those biologists, we don't need any biologists. I think we need to take advantage of them. Mr. Lavelle pointed out very well that the Selkirk master plan, elk plan, that they put out on February 1st there identified that the populations of the elk herd south of the Spokane River are increasing. The number of hunters has remained stagnant for the past 11 years. The success rate of the hunters has increased. And the claims, damage claims has been reduced.
Could you move the mic a little bit further away from your mouth? Thanks.
You kind of interrupted my thought there. The elk population down there has been, the program that the Master Hunter program for the six GMUs, 127 through 142, has been immensely successful. Now, you do the elk plans for a good reason, to set up your assets, to put your resources toward a plan. You can't have a plan that's inconsistent with your proposals, and these proposals contradict what the plan has put forward. And I think that's a direct violation of the law in Washington State. If you have a master plan, the regulations you implement are to carry out that plan. In Washington State, we have this public disclosure method where you use the CR 102, 101s to get the information. Well, the CR 102, if you guys probably did read it, and I did read it, it's not an enjoyable read, but in there, buried way down deep in there, was the changes they were proposing. At the rules meeting in August, several people asked if they were going to change anything like that, and they were told, no, we're going to talk about these six things. We're limiting to that. We're not discussing that. So what happened was the compression of the change in the rules occurred after the opportunity for the public to actually see those proposed rule changes. And so I have a real problem with bypassing the standard way rule changes occurred in the past. And I would suggest that we do that. My final suggestion is that I would support the recommending the status quo on the December master hunt in the six GMUs I mentioned. And if you are going to go ahead with the plan, set it up so that you can have a one-year test period or a single region that uses that test period so that you can make adjustments for the undesired results that you are going to get with the proposal. Do you have any questions? I'd love to answer some questions.
Any questions?
No.
Thank you for your testimony. Would Jim Craighead please come forward? And Mr. Harwood? Mr. Harwood, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Rick Harwood. I'm a landowner that lives in GMU 130 just south and adjacent to the Turnbull National Wildlife Refuge. And I'm here today because I'm mad. I'm very mad, as are a lot of my neighbors. They're not here tonight because most of them are 70 years old, and we're at the peak of calving season. So I did indicate that I'm speaking for myself, but I do represent the interests of many, many of the ranchers around our place there. I'm going to start backwards and work forward because I know I'll run out of time. I ask that you vote no on this proposal and you reject the department's request to modify and eliminate the master hunt in units 127 through 130. It wasn't even brought up today. The biggest thing is this was a surprise that was thrust upon all of us. The elk are in our hay. They're in our winter wheat fields. They're right now out on our green pastures eating our grass. And this has been a very effective management tool at taking care of the elk when they come off a Turnbull. This has been a big nightmare. We've been working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Mike Rule, the biologist there, to address it. They come off the refuge. They eat the hay. They eat the wheat. And then they run back on. So what the department's proposing now is to eliminate this, and I don't have enough time to talk about how they did that, but the bottom line is it's working just fine the way it is. And we're saying, okay, well, now we're going to open it up to general hunters. Okay, again, there's no science. Everything we've seen here has been the herd's increasing. We have an above management objective number of bull elk in that herd. We have an above average number of elk in that herd. And so we're saying, well, now we're going to go to an antlerless only permit hunt. Why? Their own data suggests that we're above management objective in each of those categories. Okay? Again, my personal thought is that it's a $6 permit. Right now, it's master hunters, and there's a certain group, and it's any elk. But if you make it a bull-only hunt, then we can make an antlerless hunt in the future. We're going to open it up to general hunters. Folks, you've got seven families that own 160 square miles south of Turnbull Refuge, all the way to the Lincoln and Whitman County lines. So where are those folks going to hunt? They're going to draw a permit. Some guy from Issaquah is going to draw that permit, and he's going to have nowhere to hunt because it's 98% private lands. So right now we've got the master hunters that come out, and they fix our fence, and they haze the elk out, and they'll shoot the cows when they get in the hay, and that's great. Everything works fine. The department says, well, there's other opportunities during the general season. The elk aren't out of the refuge during that season. They're on the refuge where they're safe until we pull the moo cows off. Moo cows come off, the elk come out. Moo cows go back out, the elk go back. So now they run into, okay, they get shot on Bellsby's place, they'll run over to Miller's. Now it's in Lincoln County. Under the new proposal, now they can't get shot. Or they'll go over to Scott Miller's. Now that's in Lincoln County. So you have a very small area of about 8 miles. And I won't take up any more of your time, but I ask that at least five of you vote no, reject this, send it back, have them do it the right way, base a proposal for the following term on some science and some data, not politics. Thank you.
Thank you. Don Dashiel, would you come forward, please? Okay, Mr. Craighead.
Hello, my name's Jim Craighead, and I've been in the Master Hunter program since its inception. And I want to kind of address the issues, there were proposed changes that we're going to have over there around the Kittitas area. I notice that we continually reduce the time that's available to hunt there. I see the department said that they're only going to make a small change due to a topographical error. And last year, our season, elk season, general elk, ended November 4th, and master hunters were allowed back in there to haze those elk that were down in the farmlands. The whole purpose of that is to get those elk back out of there. And the only way you do that is by that continual hazing of those elk to move them out. Well, I see here in their proposal, they want to move that out to November 10th. Well, that should start the day after that general season closes to continue with the good success that we've had. If you choose, you can call Sam Kaiser or Russ Stingley over there. There are two ranchers in that area that have had great success with this. When we first started hunting in that, there was 100 to 200 animals down there in their pastures. Now Sam has very few down in there. That's because we are down in there. The master hunters are continually hazing those elk out of there. They're not going to come in if you have them, they put pressure back on out. So I really want you to consider not approving this change here away from where we've historically been. We've had great success, and there's no sense in changing that. It's not going to impact the take any more than what it currently is. So I don't know if that's just an error on the department's or a move to try to move that away. I'd like for you to consider that, if you would, please. Again, the master hunters do a lot. We go back in there every spring. We put in more than 200 man hours of fence repair alone. And it's not something that the department sets up. It's something that the master hunters here in Moses Lake have put our heads together, and we've gone over and started ourselves. We've been doing this for close to 15 years and have developed some good relationships with these landowners. And we're welcome to come and help them keep the animals out. So I would encourage you to take a look at that time frame, if you would.
Thank you. Mr. Dashiel, you're the wrap-up
I'm the last one.
You are.
Oh, I hope you turn the timer off. I might have a hard time here. I want to approach this from a government to agency, not just public comment. I mean, Stevens County has something in it that we hate. You know, that's the Growth Management Act. We're a growth management county. With that bucket of lemons that we have, you know, as they say, make lemonade. Well, there's an RCW for state agencies and dealing with plans and growth management counties that they have to comply with the comprehensive plan that we had to develop because we're growth management. I can't tell you which RCW it is. Somebody that likes to look at those will tell you, but it requires that the agency, any plan they put onto the county has to comply with our comprehensive plan. And the elements of our plan have goals in the different segments, the element for natural resources, agriculture, you know, which would include timber and farming and the cattle industry, require or state that our goal is any state plan has to maintain or enhance that natural resource element. It has to maintain or enhance, you know, a wildlife element that we have too, or the problem I see with that, you know, the Selkirk, the north of Spokane part of it, and I agree completely on the parts that I heard about on the southern, you know, the Spokane subherd. 117 is bull only now. You would put 105, 108, and 121 into a bull only. That's a 1,500 head herd in the north of the Spokane River. We're a bit worried since we're kind of the prime agricultural valley there with some forest service on each side that you're not going to equally distribute. If you have two elk in Pend'Oreille County, you're not going to get two more. And if you have three in Okanagan, you're not going to get three more there. The additional 1,500 very well could be on the fringes of our valley. Not to mention that we have a fountain at the south end of Stevens County, which is called Spokane Indian Reservation, which has several hundred elk. I won't use any secret information that my cousins on the res told me as to how many there are there, but that fountain, those elk are, you know, I call them refugees from the reservation. When they don't like it there, they come north. So there's several hundred elk there that if we go bull only, you know, the either sex deal is help keep that, as the refugees come off, keep that trim down, as the ones that come out of 117 where they are doing some ag damage that's not being addressed. You know, a claim was put in for some ag damage, and the agents that went there just went down and said, well, you don't qualify because you didn't protect your haystack good enough. And that's why I guess the depredation fund is in such good shape, because they don't pay any of it out. And in the news release, it said the elk plan must be finalized before changes in the seasons and regulations could be made. I don't see any way that whoever's in charge of the plan, which I believe is Kevin Robinette, can make enough trips to Stevens County to make sure the plan that they want to put in here will meet with all of our goals for our comprehensive plan, and that according to state law, it has to meet them. So I guess I would suggest we delay this and until all that can be done.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. We did have someone come in late. Ray Barr, would you come forward? I'm not sure you have heard the commission rules, but we give each person 3 minutes. And right. When you hear the beeping noise, your time is up.
Okay. Some of the things that I wanted to talk about is changes you're making in, like, with the archery. I'm an archer and a master hunter. Everything that I go through in the classes and everything with my boys and everything all has to do with being ethical. You keep pushing archers closer and closer to the 1st of September. When you do that, we're going to be hunting in times when you're going to have people from the west side up in the hills. You talk about how you don't want us to infringe on other people's values. By pushing us into that earlier section of time, we have no choice. Ethically, that's wrong. You guys speak of ethics in everything, the code of ethics for master hunters, code of ethics for hunting, period, or fishing, any game thing, and that's what we try and teach our kids is ethics. You know, if I'm out there and I'm getting an animal, and am I supposed to cover it up so, you know, mom and dad from Western Washington are bringing their kids up there don't freak out because they see a dead animal? I don't understand why the archery season keeps getting pushed and why muzzleloader and rifle stay on a weekend opener. You know, that's one of the biggest issues I have is why those that keeps getting moved. We keep getting into the hotter times of the year. Ethical, it also goes in the fact that if you kill an animal, you treat it with respect. That animal dies, you try and get it to cooled off, whatever. Everybody knows what that's about. If you don't, you lose meat. You lose an animal. You could lose a whole animal because you're in the heat of the day, and you're trying to not do that. How is that ethical to treat that animal that way? You'll get more people leaving animals because you can't take it with you. I mean, it's totally unethical. I think it needs to be at least set to where we are the weekend after Labor Day on a Saturday like everybody else. The other thing about it is you also talk about in the rule changes is in the Master Hunter deal, the Master Hunter program is not supposed to infringe on any other seasons. All the seasons get shut down. If you're a Master Hunter, when modern season opens, Master Hunters cannot be hunting. Okay. So when the modern season opens, they've got fair right at, same with muzzleloaders, same thing. Okay, we can't infringe on them. But archery gets infringed on. Okay, your late hunt that you're setting up, or I haven't been here and I apologize, where the archery late season is going to be, we're going to end up having to hunt down in with the master hunters. Because there's no possible way in the Clockham for us to get antlerless clear up on the top of the Clockham without snowmobiles, quads, and things like that. Just a few ethical, you know, you guys point to ethical stuff, and that's where we want to go. I want to be ethical, and I want to teach my kids that, and you guys should be behind that all the way. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that concludes the public input portion of that agenda item. We've reached the end of today's meeting. So we'll be returning tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. Not 8:30. 8 a.m. So we can leave our books here. Yes, the room will be locked. And do we have any committee meetings tonight? Is the Fish Committee meeting? Commissioner Mencken? He's not. Is the Fish Committee meeting?
No, we don't have
meetings. Okay, no meetings. Okay, see you in the morning.